From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the 30th day of April 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo of Global Commodity Analytics. He's in Lafayette, Indiana. And later in this half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with Bruce Bostard. He's the manager of the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois. In the second half hour of our program on many of these radio stations and always online at willag.org, we'll talk with John Reynolds of Rabobank Ag Finance. Dave Dickey will be here, of course, with the agricultural news for the afternoon. And we'll check in with what's been happening with University of Illinois Extension and how it played a pivotal role in the development of no-till. Right here on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
This stock and commodity report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from Bates Commodities in Normal, providing clients with the latest market information based on research by ADM Investor Services and other independent sources. Bates Commodities can be reached at 1-800-383-4647 or on the internet at batescom.net.
In Chicago, on this Friday afternoon, settlement prices came in like this. A lot of green on the screen for the day. The May wheat, a 491¾ settlement price, up 7¼. July at 503, 7½ cents higher in the September futures. $5.18¾, up 7¼. May corn futures, 366¼, 5¾ higher. July at 375¼, up 6¼. And September, 383½, up 7¼. December futures, 392¼, 8½ cents higher. In the March corn, $4.05, a gain today of 8¼ cents. From the soy complex, the May futures, $9.89½, 3¾ higher. July at $9.99, up 3. August beans at $9.97½, 3½ higher. September futures there at $9.83¾, up 4¼. November soybeans, $9.75¾. The new crop settled 5¼ higher. May bean meal at $2.91.30, up $3.90. July at $3.90, rather $2.93.10, up $4.10. The red came in the bean oil. The May contract down 22 cents at $38.58. July at $38.93. Down 22. Now to the livestock side of the CME group. Nearby April live cattle, 99, 92½, 95 cents higher. June at 94, 22½, up 35. May feeders at 112.80, 27½ higher. The August contract at 116 and 7½ cents, up a quarter as well. And the May lean hog futures today, $89.52½ a settlement, $1.92½ higher. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media in Urbana. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures, June contract, $86.05, a settlement price, 88 cents. That's actually not a settlement. It's still trading, up 88 cents, though. July at 88.26, up a buck and a penny. Ethanol at $1.60 2/10, 2/10 of a cent higher in the nearby May contract, and natural gas at $3.92 1/10, down 5 9/10 for the day. Heating oil at 228 8/10, 3 7/10 higher. And the gold futures on the afternoon at $1,180.10, a settlement price, $11.70 an ounce higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average just about 100 points lower at 11,067. The U.S. dollar down 0.13 at 81.86. And the CRB index at 277.71 is up 2.42. The Goldman Sachs today, 549.14. Up 4.69 on the afternoon. Here's what the weather forecast for the two-state region looks like. A flash flood watch is in effect for far southern Illinois and southwestern Indiana. That from this evening through Sunday evening, and for south central Indiana from Saturday morning through Sunday evening. A lake wind advisory is in effect for the southern parts of Illinois and the southwestern parts of Indiana until 6 p.m. Tonight in Illinois, cloudy, showers and thunderstorms. In Indiana, becoming cloudy and showers, some thunderstorms after midnight. Lows will range this evening from 53 in far northwestern Illinois to 65 in the south. And then tomorrow in northern and central Illinois, a mix of clouds, some sunshine in northern Indiana, mostly cloudy. A chance of a few scattered showers in central Indiana and the south. Cloudy, scattered showers and thunderstorms. Highs tomorrow in the mid-70s. Severe thunderstorms, primarily with some damaging wind and some isolated thunderstorms, are possible late this afternoon and this evening, and likely in the western two-thirds of the state and possible tonight in the eastern third of Illinois.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report from Illinois Public Media. It's a Friday afternoon. On the line with us, Big Mike Zuzolo of Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting in Lafayette, Indiana. Hi, Mike. How are you?
Hi, Todd. Sorry, I was under the desk.
Yeah. You know what? Once in a while you come in and it takes a combination of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 buttons to get you on the air.
I understand completely, and, you know, you'd be surprised at this little office how many things can go wrong during a day.
Usually I get, I look down, and once in a while you can hear it on the air when I make that mistake. Usually it's a matter of you hear that kind of on the air, and I know what that is immediately, and I fix that. But, boy, I looked around, and I was like, son of a gun, I don't know where Mike went. Like, fortunately, our TD, Jason Croft, was here to salvage me and save the day. So let's talk about the marketplace. Kind of an interesting week, I suggested to you early in the market for the week. And as we look at the numbers and we finish up, let's see, corn on the week was up 13, 14 cents for
right,
the beans.
Right, and you know, it's funny, we talked about this last week where we're a little bit more optimistic on the corn, less optimistic on the beans just because of that bean-corn ratio and some of the fundamental factors that were starting to permeate, you know, from South America and how expensive the beans were for China to be buying. And we didn't even know about the Chinese deal yet, but the Chinese deal kind of solidified all week long the unwinding of intercommodity spreading, and I think you saw that on the weekly numbers, Todd, when you had corn up 14, like you say, in the December, but no beans is going to close down about 3.25, and July wheat's going to close down about 1.5 for the week. So you have this unwrapping or unwinding of long bean, long wheat positions against short corn positions, and we have, you know, primarily China to thank for that. I think maybe the weather, especially the wetter weather coming into the Ohio River Valley, Tennessee River Valley, and Delta, maybe supported the beans a little more than I was expecting, and the meal as well. But as a whole, this week did stick to the game plan that traders are starting to unwrap that long bean, short corn bias and get more long corn, short beans.
Do we have many details about the Chinese deal?
Well, we don't. I mean, we have details depending on what source you look at. I've seen details of only 150 to 200,000 tons being purchased. I've seen details of 300,000 tons being purchased. I've seen details this afternoon of 1 million or 500,000 tons being purchased, with another 500,000 coming and a total of 1 million metric tons being purchased. I've seen actual news information out of Tokyo from grain traders saying that they probably do not expect this market rally to last because these prices over in Asia are just too high to be able to be sustained. So I think that may have permeated into the trade along with this Gulf oil spill and caused some of the longs yesterday to pull back a little bit and reevaluate and let the technicals do their job today, and which they did.
Now, can you go back into the Chinese thing just a bit? Is there a reason fundamentally that the market believes that they're in for so much corn at this time?
You know, the best source that I found this week was the U.S. Grains Council man that did a press release and also went into a little bit more detail in a report that stated, and I go along with this because of the DDG consumption and the meal consumption that we've seen the last few months, that they had enough hog diseases and hog problems over in their domestic hog population. They had to repopulate and bring back their breeding herd, and therefore they're trying to ramp up in a faster manner their production number for pork, and I think that makes a lot of sense based upon what we've seen the last 7 or 8 months. So he's the one, I think, that was primarily the most reliable source saying once they get in, they're going to be in for a while because they need the corn. The other thing that really kind of shakes you up a little bit is if you're like me, I was thinking they'd come in, China would come in and buy maybe in 2, 3, 4 months down the road here after planting on the idea that we've got a post-planting low in place. Coming in this early makes you wonder whether there's more damage being done because of their northern plain being so dry and the fact that their acreage for corn may actually be down because they've missed their primary window. I can't get any hard numbers or any hard facts on that, but it makes you wonder why they jumped in early.
Now, let's go back to the disease. I'm going to make some leaps here, and you tell me whether I'm right or wrong.
If I can. I may not know any more than you on that.
Yeah, it seems to me that the problem they had was more likely a couple of years ago in their hog herd. They had blue ear. We heard
right.
That, we heard a lot about that. That is PRRS, what we're what we would call it in the United States. It's a similar strain. It's more virulent, but it's a similar strain. And then if they had to eliminate their sow herd at that point, it would take them a while to get enough breeding animals back in place, I suppose, to get a herd up and running. I'm wondering how long that would actually take. I suppose 18 months might work. 18 or 19 months, and then we'd start coming up to capacity. Although you'd think they'd have an awful lot of corn just on hand because of a lack of hogs in their system over that time frame. Were they shipping it out?
Well, you're right. No, two things there. I think you're right. It has to have started back, you know, probably in the 2008, early 2009 time period. You also had the melamine scare back during that time period.
Right.
I think that had to work itself out as well. I think one thing we have to realize about China is they move very slow. You know, you talk about the wheels of justice or the wheels of commerce in this country working slow, but I think in China it's even slower because you have to have the government on your side to do anything, and they're very, very slow over there. So I'm assuming that that took some extra time to get their hog population ramped up. The other thing I think about is the logistical issue of the corn and how hard it was for them to get the corn from the north to the south. Their southern drought this past summer, which really is one of the worst, and from what I've seen, 70 to 100 years. And so I think there's a combination of issues there. They have been selling an enormous amount on the domestic market. I think 1.4 million tons is going to be let go of again at auction next week. And yet you still have their domestic price running around $7 to $7.20 a bushel, and which is about, you know, for us, our price differential is about $50 a metric ton, which is about $1.40, $1.45 a bushel. So that's what the trade is focusing on right now, is when does that domestic price drop enough that it makes sense that they don't need to import anymore. But, again, I would say that U.S. Grains Council person is kind of a boots-on-the-ground type person. I put a lot of stock in what he's saying.
So let me see if we can't put this in a longer-term package. Would you think that this, and I guess this is the big bet, is will it continue or not? And that mostly depends on whether their price comes back into line.
I think you have to stick to your risk management principles when you look at something like this out of China, because you know what their buying history is on soybeans and how long they can keep buying. They do have the money to buy. There's no question about that. But I guess to answer your question is, I think it's going to last longer than maybe the trade thinks. But I have no way of knowing that, Todd. And so you don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater in terms of if we get back up to profitable levels in corn and you've got a very high February crop insurance price, or you know, pretty good crop insurance price from February,
right,
and you have a second chance to lock in a profitable level. To me, it's just like we've been talking about. Look at the beans, get more aggressive on selling beans, give the corn a chance to rally, but don't let that chance pass you by, because you can use risk management tools to protect the upside and use your crop insurance to protect you on the downside. Let's take this golf issue a little bit very briefly. If we have sky-high crude oil prices, and we end up having an issue with gasoline and diesel prices hurting our economy, we may be back in the dumper as far as grain demand later this year. So there's too many uncertainties to let profits sneak away.
All right. Anything else to add before I let you go for the afternoon?
That'll do it. Have a great weekend.
Hey, you too. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Todd.
And that is Mike Zuzulo. He's with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Lafayette, Indiana. Joins us here on the Closing Mark Report on a Friday afternoon.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Dave Dickey will be here in a moment with the Ag News.
In agricultural news, a group of lawmakers say that the U.S. needs to quickly comply with a World Trade Organization ruling by reforming market-distorting subsidies paid to the U.S. cotton industry. U.S. negotiators this month arranged a deal that would pay Brazil $147 million per year not to retaliate. The plan is to keep paying Brazil until the next farm bill to be written by Congress in 2012, and the cotton subsidies would be overhauled then. But Representative Ron Kind, a Democrat from Wisconsin, says it's absurd to waste that much money in payments to Brazil. Kind says, quote, The concern is $147 million a year. That's going to be $500 million before we have a chance to address the subsidy programs. The crop biotechnology industry is growing frustrated as it watches the approval time for new seeds almost double under the Obama administration, and it is pressuring Washington to clear inventories more quickly. The logjam at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which must clear genetically modified seeds, is slowing the launch of products that could give farmers more alternatives. Also, biotech industry executives are worrying that delays signal that the Obama administration, which has painted itself as pro-biotech, is gearing up for a far tougher analysis of the potential environmental impact of GMO crops. A former trader has been charged with fraud for causing $141 million in losses to brokerage firm MF Global in 2008 by executing unauthorized trades in Chicago Board of Trade wheat futures. Evan Brent Dooley, 42, of Olive Branch, Mississippi, was charged with 16 counts of wire fraud and 2 counts of violating the Commodities Exchange Act's speculative position limits. The indictment is the latest twist in a case that, in addition to the $141 million in trading losses, rattled commodity markets, decimated the stock of MF Global Holdings, and resulted in fines against the brokerage from the U.S. Futures Regulatory Agency and the CME Group, which owns the Chicago Board of Trade. The Buenos Aires Grain Exchange now puts Argentina's 2009-2010 soybean crop at a record 54.8 million metric tons. That's even higher than the previous estimate for 54.5 million metric tons. And Brazil will increase the blend of anhydrous ethanol and gasoline back to 25%. The decision will take effect on May 2nd. In January, the government reduced temporarily the blend of anhydrous ethanol and gasoline to 20% to avoid any shortages ahead of the next sugarcane harvest. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, the host of the Closing Mark Report, Commodity Week, and the Farming World. All three of those programs you can find online at willag.org. We'll have Commodity Week posted by about 6 o'clock this evening on a Friday night. Our guest this week is Brian Hoops. And then later in this program today on some of these radio stations, we'll talk with John Reynolds. He's with Rabobank out of St. Louis, Missouri. Now up next, did you know that no-till was developed right here in Illinois at the Dixon Springs Experiment Station? I'll have all the details. It was here in deep southern Illinois, close to the Shawnee National Forest and the furthest north cypress swamp in the United States, that the modern era of farming was challenged and changed. The lands roll, and when it rains, wash away into the Ohio and Mississippi rivers by the ton. Or at least they did, until a University of Illinois agronomist decided there had to be a better way to grow crops on the hillsides. For 37 years, George McKibben experimented and evangelized what was to become the modern era of no-till farming. Illinois agronomist Steve Ebelhair explains the effects of the research can be seen throughout the southern Illinois landscape.
Oh, absolutely, because back in the 30s and 40s when the area was still under conventional tillage system, we saw a lot of really gully erosion, a lot of water coming off the fields just saturated with soil, just dark soil moving off the profiles, off the landscapes. And now when you see a rain, you know, it's mostly clearer water, not a lot of soil movement because the residues are helping hold the soil in place. So we don't see the gullies that we once saw under conventional till system where the water has moved tremendous amounts of soil off the profiles.
What really made George McKibben's no-till experiments at Dixon Springs work as a soil-saving tool was pretty simple. And there's a reason it took so long for farmers to adopt the practice, meaning reasons it wasn't thought of or worked on prior to the 1960s. The technology to control weeds hadn't been developed and adapted to the farm before that time. The herbicides allowed McKibben's no-till experiments to work, says Ebelhair.
It's really the merger of good weed control herbicides coming into the market and the pioneering efforts of George McKibben that really made no-till take off in the early 60s into the 70s.
And then in the mid-1990s, when the herbicide-resistant varieties of soybeans were introduced, no-till really began to boom. The crop had been modified to withstand being sprayed with a herbicide, and no-till acres around the nation and in Illinois jumped. The first time no-till soybean acres outnumbered any other tillage method in the state of Illinois came in 2007, 41 years after George McKibben planted his first no-till experiment at Dixon Springs. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason. Todd Gleason, you're listening to the Closing Market Report. Bruce Bostert is here. Basis and your numbers very quickly, Bruce.
Switch from the May to the July today and did it well. Basis hang in there. So 355 on nearby corn and 981 on the soybeans.
You're the man. You got it all in. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bruce Bostert is with Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois. Back in 2 minutes when we take a look at the agricultural weather forecast.
It's National Oatmeal Cookie Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1865, Robert Fitzroy died. A British naval officer and meteorologist, Fitzroy devised a storm warning system that was the prototype of the daily weather forecast. He also invented a barometer and published the weather book. In 1872, Louis Pasteur lectured at the French Academy of Science in support of his germ theory of disease, in which he held that many diseases were caused by tiny organisms. In 1904, the Louisiana Purchase Exposition opened in St. Louis. It was at the fair that the ice cream cone was reported to be invented. The hot dog and iced tea were also popularized at the fair. In 1952, Mr. Potato Head is introduced to the world. The original Mr. Potato contained 70 body parts, but parents had to supply children with real potatoes for the body. Mr. Potato Head was the first toy to be advertised on television, and the advertising blitz netted Hasbro more than $100 million in the first year of production. Mrs. Potato Head came a year later in 1953. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Listening to the Closing Market Report. It's a production of Illinois Public Media. On a Friday afternoon, Steve Hilberg of NOAA's Midwestern Regional Climate Center is here to talk about the agricultural weather forecast. Good afternoon to you, Steve.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Looks like we're going to have a rainy weekend. Is that still in the forecast for us?
Yeah, it won't be continuous, but it looks like the nice sunny weather we have here in eastern Illinois right now is, and actually most of Illinois, is going to be a memory. We have a fairly strong cold front to the west right now, and there's a tornado watch in effect from roughly Peoria to Lake County, Illinois, and on northward. There's a severe thunderstorm watch back through Missouri, which will likely be reissued as a tornado watch here this afternoon in the near future, and just a general line of thunderstorms there as the day and the night goes on, those will gradually spread over the remainder of Illinois. Fortunately, it looks like they'll move out tomorrow morning fairly early. That'll leave things, nothing will be falling from the sky probably during the marathon tomorrow here in Champaign-Urbana. But then the front's going to stall a little bit to our east, and another wave of low pressure will move up along that front and bring another round of potentially heavy rain, especially for the southern half of Illinois, for Saturday night into Sunday morning. And then after that, the worst of it will be over, but we'll still be dealing with maybe some scattered showers into Monday, and then the next chance again Thursday. So we're not really going to be in a dry period the next week or so.
You know, I kind of forgot about the Illinois Marathon tomorrow morning, Saturday morning here in Champaign-Urbana. That's a big event, 15,000 to 20,000, I think, we're expected, aren't they?
Yeah, it's fortunately, they're going to catch a good window, it looks like, between these weather systems. It wasn't looking quite so promising early in the week, but it is now. And actually tomorrow, most of tomorrow, except for southern Illinois, will probably be dry in Illinois. But then things will start rolling in late tomorrow afternoon from the southwest as this wave of low pressure comes up. So we'll have some good rain tonight, especially in the western part of the state. It'll probably get the heaviest. And then over tomorrow night and early Sunday, southern Illinois, more or less south of I-70, could pick up several inches of rain from this next wave of low pressure coming through tomorrow night. So there's going to probably be a little few issues with that down in southern Illinois on Sunday, but that'll gradually move out, and we'll get a few days of not-so-wet weather.
And since we're ending the month here, why don't you tell me how April looked climatologically?
Well, actually, it started out looking like it was going to be a relative scorcher, meaning extremely warm. But things have tempered a bit with the last few days and some cooler weather. But in general, across Illinois, it's going to be anywhere from 4 to 6 degrees above normal, and that will be pushing record warmth in many areas. We were running 10 to 12 at one point about mid-month, but we've got some cool weather, especially cool nights, has helped temper that. In terms of the precipitation, by the time this tomorrow's here, tonight's over, most of the state will have received near normal or above normal precipitation for April.
All right. Thanks so much, Steve.
Okay, Todd.
Steve Hilberg is the director of NOAA's Midwestern Regional Climate Center. It's located at the Illinois State Water Survey right here in Urbana-Champaign. We'll say so long to many of our stations at the moment. Some of you will stay with us for the Farming World this afternoon. We'll talk with John Reynolds. He's with Rabobank Ag Finance.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
University of Illinois Extension.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
This is the Farming World, news and interviews from the land grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today our topic is agricultural finance. We're joined by the Senior Vice President and Chief Appraiser for Rabo AgriFinance out of St. Louis, Missouri. His name is John Reynolds. Thank you, Mr. Reynolds, for joining us today.
Thank you, Todd. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Rabobank of America is familiar to some folks, but not to others. Can you tell me how it came to the United States and a little bit of history about the bank?
Rabobank, of course, was started in the late 1800s in Netherlands, actually between Germany and Netherlands, and is a bank cooperative over there. They're owned by member banks. It's not a publicly owned bank. And they first came to America in about 1981 at the beginning of the farm crisis as a wholesale banker. They made loans to the larger commercial agribusinesses, feedlots, processors, warehouses, transportation, and so forth like that, for food and agriculture.
And why do they, it seems odd maybe that a bank of this size, because it is a very large bank, right?
Yes, $800-900 billion assets.
But they're really based in agricultural finance around the globe?
Yes, that's sort of the niche market. That was their roots as a banking cooperative, and that's where they've chosen to stay throughout the years.
And how have they entered the U.S. market?
They actually entered the U.S. market, like I say, in about 1981. Established offices, I think there were four offices, one in New York, Chicago, Atlanta, Dallas. I guess there was five. There was one in San Francisco. And they did a lot of joint financing with other banks. They would participate in banks. They were a participating bank for a lot of banks and insurance companies. In fact, one of our predecessor companies did some loan participations with Rabble Bank for some commercial agribusinesses back in the early and mid-'80s.
And then the company in the 2000s expanded pretty dramatically across the United States. Is that correct?
That's correct. With the wholesale banking, we had customers who were requesting that we be able to go into retail banking. So they started out in California, buying a agricultural bank out there, and have expanded that tremendously. And then in 2003, they purchased the Lend-Lease Agribusiness, which is a predecessor company of ours, and they purchased also Ag Services of America out of Cedar Falls, Iowa, and in 2004, those were merged to Rabble Agri-Finance.
Is that where you came from? Did you come from Cedar Falls? I think I saw that in your name.
I did not.
I
actually came from the Lend-Lease Agribusiness. Equitable Agribusiness was a predecessor company to that. We were agents for Equitable Life Insurance and the Farm Mortgage Department.
Hey, I need a couple of quick definitions. What's the difference between wholesale lending in agriculture and retail?
Facilities similar to commercial banks that you would have on the corner in most towns.
Mr. Reynolds, you're a senior vice president. You're the chief appraiser. What does that mean your job happens to be at Rabble Bank?
With being a bank, we're required to separate the appraisal function from credit and from marketing. So we have an appraisal department. We have a small staff of appraisers spread out over the country, and we're responsible for the valuations of our security, our properties we take as security for loans.
So you actually work for Rabble Agri-Finance, which is a subsidiary then of the bank?
Yes. We're a wholly owned subsidiary of Rabble Bank. Yes, sir.
Okay. So now, tell me about appraising farmland and what you do.
Most of our appraisals, we when a relationship managers need an appraisal, they're making a loan that may be secured by ag real estate. Why we get an appraisal request from the marketing department, we take that and we either do the appraisal ourselves, or in most instances we use outside appraisers, independent contractors, that we hire to do individual assignments. We engage those appraisers. We get the appraisal back. We review it, make sure it meets the requirements and it follows our compliance process and procedures, and then work with our closing department to make sure that we have all our accounting and everything entered accurately so our records are correct.
So what's the data entry on that look like? And I guess I'm asking, when you do the appraisal and you've contracted with somebody, surely they get a set of standard questions that they're to answer. Do those vary by region and commodity, I suppose, and commodity produced on the land, that is? And what's involved? What's that standard form ask?
Well, of course, the standard form is the uniform, is USPAP, Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practice. The appraisals have to meet those, as well as FIREA, which is the Financial Institutions Reform Recovery Act, which is the law that all banks are federally regulated financial institutions have to abide by. And the uniform standards deal with descriptions of the property. We have to describe the property and describe what the problem to solve is. Our problem is what the market value is, as per definition from the from FIREA, of what the market definition is of value.
Layman terms.
What will what is property worth? Not necessarily what it will bring.
I mean layman terms. In if you take that document, what does the layman terms tell you that you're asking? What kind of questions are you asking about the property? Or maybe I'm just going down the wrong road.
What's the physical characteristics of the property? The productivity. What's it being used for? What it is being used for? What it could be used for? Whether it's development, whether it's transitional, the type of buildings or improvements that are on the property. Is it irrigated? Is it non-irrigated? Information, and then of course it boils down to what's that property worth, how many acres is it, how much is it worth per acre, and what the total value is.
Have you watched, and I know you have, but can you give me an assessment of how property values have changed in the last decade?
In the last decade, real estate values have continued to have increased. Coming out of the 90s, the 90s were primarily a recovery from the farm crisis of the 80s, and farmland was increased, but at a pretty nominal rate in most areas. It was based on the income and the variability of income that farms had, for particularly in the Midwest. The price of corn and soybeans was a lot of times pretty volatile. So the values of land was fairly stable during that time. In the last decade, it started out, the lands were still fairly stable, but increasing in a relatively small amount. You'd have areas that were different than others, whether it was orange groves in Florida or citrus groves in California or dairies. Dairies were enjoying fairly prosperous times and feedlots in the early 2000s. And then about 2007, with the with the vent of ethanol and the commodity prices increasing dramatically, while real estate values pretty well skyrocketed. And that happened until the financial crisis that happened in the summer of 2008. Land values pretty much stabilized at that time. In some areas, they came down, of course. the land that was influenced by transitional value, whether it was development or recreational, took the biggest hit in decline in value. Good land, good ag, productive ag land, continued to remain at least stable, in some cases up. The beginning of late 2009, 2010, those values have rebounded, and in 2010, we're seeing historic highs in values in a lot of areas for good farmland, for less productive land or land that's out of the territories or out of areas that are less conventional farms or don't have the productive capacity. Those properties have stabilized and have not risen near as much, but good productive farmland, there is now a big demand for that.
We're talking to Senior Vice President and Chief Appraiser for Rabo AgriFinance, John Reynolds. You're listening, of course, to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. More in a moment.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
In business news, the Commerce Department today says that the U.S. economy grew at a slightly slower than expected pace in the first quarter, held back by inventories and exports. Gross domestic product expanded at a 3.2% pace. Analysts had forecast GDP, which measures total goods and services output within the U.S. borders, growing at a 3.4% rate after a 5.6% growth pace in the fourth quarter. Despite the slowdown, details of the report were fairly upbeat, with consumer spending accelerating at a 3.6% rate, more than double the 1.6% pace in the fourth quarter. Federal prosecutors are conducting a criminal investigation into whether Goldman Sachs Group or its employees committed securities fraud in connection with its mortgage trading. The investigation from the Manhattan U.S. Attorney's Office, which is in a preliminary stage, stemmed from a referral from the Securities and Exchange Commission. And Chevron Corporation says its first quarter profit more than doubled as oil prices soared over the past year. The oil company reported income of $4.55 billion, or $2.27 per share, for the first 3 months of the year. That compares with $1.84 billion, or 92 cents per share, in the same part of 2009. Revenue increased 33% to $48.18 billion. Chevron's results were boosted by a surge in profits from its exploration and production operation. And that's a look at today's business news.
This afternoon, we're talking with Senior Vice President and Chief Appraiser for Rabo AgriFinance, John Reynolds. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You're listening to The Farming World from Illinois Public Media. Mr. Reynolds, when we last spoke, you were discussing the price of farmland and how it's changed over the last couple of decades. Can you tell me, in different regions of the country, where the prime farmland might be? You mentioned that the price of farmland that wasn't so prime had dropped some recently. But where are the prime farmlands, and what kinds of commodities are grown on those lands?
Of course, the bulk of the prime farmland is located Illinois, Iowa, parts of northern Indiana, Ohio, And then you go down through the Delta region, down through the Boot Hill of Missouri and eastern Arkansas and western Mississippi and then eastern Louisiana. And through the Delta is a prime area along the Midwest, western Kansas, and parts of Nebraska where a lot of the irrigated land is. And then you got a pretty significant tract of good farmland up in North and South Dakota along the Red River Valley, and western Minnesota and eastern North and South Dakota is where the bulk of the good arable productive ag land is.
Then how about places like Washington, California, Florida?
Parts of those states do, particularly California. California, the San Joaquin Valley is known as the breadbasket of the world, really. There's that one state has as much as ag production as most countries of the world does. So that is a big area. The West is very dependent on water, and that's been issues, whether it's in California or Oregon, Washington, Idaho. As long as they have availability of water, then they can produce a lot of ag products and have a good economy. But that is a situation that is somewhat variable, where the particularly the upper Midwest and the area where you're located at has a lot of natural climate that makes for a high productive area.
You missed a couple of other states I'm interested in. Montana, which I suppose isn't that great a productive state, but they do produce hard red winter wheat there. I suppose that farmland, what do you consider that farmland in value?
That farmland has, of course, it started out anywhere from $200 to $300 per acre for the good dry land, wheat land. A lot of that land is fallow. Every other year at least is fallow. You have to, because of the lack of moisture that they have. But it's good land, but it's located in an area that the climate is pretty harsh, and they're big farms, but. The values now are there in that area. They've probably tripled in value, but when compared to some of the other land in the country, it still seems fairly cheap.
How about the irrigated farmland south of Amarillo, Texas, where they grow a lot of corn?
That land has been impacted by a lot of dairies that have moved into the West Texas and Eastern New Mexico area, and they've been driven by the demand for feed, corn primarily, and some soybeans. And, of course, at one time that land had some issues with water in the Ogallala Aquifer and the cost of pumping that water. But in recent years, while the aquifer has been able to recharge. There's been a lot of change in technology and irrigation with the center pivots that has conserved a lot of water. But that land has changed, and it's changing hands. And most recently, some of that land has had some stress in the values because of the dairy industry has had stress in it for 12 to 24 months now.
Right.
And that has caused some of that land that's recently sold to be at least stable or decline slightly in value.
Okay. I didn't leave very much time, but I want to talk about a pivotal state, I think, in the ethanol industry and the way things have changed. Kansas has gone from a hard red winter wheat producing state to a corn producing state. How's that changed the property values there?
Property values have increased there considerably, particularly in southwest Kansas, where they have a lot of irrigation, and they can get 200 plus bushels per acre of corn there on a fairly consistent basis now. And of course, a lot of the larger dairies and even the hog producing area facilities and companies have moved to southwest Kansas and western Oklahoma, the panhandle of Texas. A lot of that has to do with getting away from populous areas, but they've been able to adapt corn with new technology and biotechnology that has varieties of corn and crops have been able to grow out there, and that has enhanced the value considerably.
And John Reynolds is Vice President and Chief Appraiser for Rabo AgriFinance. You can always find them online at www.rabobankamerica, that's all one word, .com. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You've been listening to The Farming World. It's a production of Illinois Public Media.